Spirit Guide Underground Porch 52008.
Warning, access restricted. Enter password. BDNA verification. Processing. Verification complete. Access granted. Welcome. Spirit.
Hello and welcome to the Monitor Room at the Spirit Blade Underground Podcast. I'm Peter France and the creator of Spirit Blade Productions. We're bringing you Christian sci-fi and fantasy that's unsterilized, unsafe, and unleashed on your ears and imagination. Check out what we're doing and grab lots of cool downloads over at www.spiritblade.net. Just click on the media icon at the top, and you'll see a bunch of cool stuff that you can download, behind-the-scenes features and commentaries and all kinds of cool stuff that I've really enjoyed putting together for you guys. I hope you have been checking them out. All right, well, let's go ahead and jump into updates.
Update information.
All right, this week, I don't want to say finished, because I'm going to be coming back to it, but I finished work on the song that I've been working on for the last couple of weeks. There's a few little minor sound effects and layers and stuff that I'll add to it, but I'll get to that when I get back a week from now. We're going to... I'll get to that in a second, but... So anyway, I have burned basically all of the scenes that I've mixed together so far, including the songs that are completed in the appropriate places, onto two discs to take with me to listen on the road this week when my family is on vacation. So that will be interesting to just kind of listen to everything, because I've been mixing in chronological order, so I'm going to listen to everything I've done so far in chronological order. Already, I've got well over 80 minutes of Spirit Blade done, completed, basically in the can. And it's a wild thing. I mean, I'm a little bit past the halfway point. So at this point, I'm wondering if two 80-minute discs is going to be enough to fit the whole thing on, if I'm going to have to cut a little bit. Rest assured, if I have to cut anything, it'll just be a few pauses. I'll shorten a few transitions. I'll do everything I can to cut just... you know, editing stuff, and before I cut actual lines and dialogue, and if I do have to cut lines and dialogue, rest assured, it will be stuff that is the least entertaining and the least important. So, that's kind of what I'm looking at right now, so that will be exciting to do. I'm surprised that at this point, it's looking like Dark Ritual is actually going to be a little bit longer than Spirit Blade. I thought, if anything, originally it would be shorter. So I'm not really sure. I think it's because I've been letting stuff breathe a little bit more, if that makes more sense. I think that in Spirit Blade, things were pretty densely packed. Dialogue was pretty densely packed. There weren't a lot of pauses. There wasn't a lot of silences. It's not moving slow by any means, I don't think, in Dark Ritual, in terms of the pacing of dialogue and things like that. But there are some scenes, because there's a lot more emotional weight to what's happening to the characters in Dark Ritual, there's scenes where I will extend silences for just, you know, a second or two longer. I'm just letting the thing breathe a little bit, and the dialogue isn't quite as densely packed, so that it so that you settle into the scenes just a little bit more. So I think that's probably, you know, what's caused that. But the effect, I think, is a really good one. I think it's overall in Dark Ritual, I feel like these characters, you know, we established in Spirit Blade kind of their stereotypes, if you will. You know, Vincent, big, tough, strong guy, dark Batman type, and Ran, you know, sensitive, intelligent, you know, smart, noble kind of guy, you know, and Merrick's the fish out of water and stuff like that, you know. So I feel like we've kind of established their stereotypes, and now we're really dealing with kind of real human character issues, real human emotions and stuff like that. And it takes a little bit more time and breathing room to do that realistically, believably, empathetically, you know, and all that kind of stuff. So I think you guys are going to really enjoy the result. But as I said, it's kind of a surprise to me that it looks like it's going to go maybe a little bit longer than Spirit Blade did. So I'll probably have to put, you know, it's a possibility I'll have to put any special features like a blooper reel and stuff like that on the site to download there instead of on the CD. It'd be great if I could at least fit a blooper reel on there, because I thought that was fun to put it on there last time. But I'd rather get as much of the story on there as I possibly can. So, all right, so that's it for updates. Let's go ahead and dive into our main feature.
Primary feature.
Movie information.
Activated.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about superhero movies over at Comics to Film. It was IESB, I believe, that had the original story of Bryan Singer talking about coming back to make Superman Returns. And he also comments a little bit about the disappointment over Superman Returns. And kind of his response to it is that movie made $400 million. I don't know what constitutes underperforming these days. Look, I can understand, I suppose, that what some people mean. Perhaps some people went in with the expectation of it being like an X-Men film, and Superman is a tougher character than that, especially bringing him back. It really goes back to the fact that you can only please some of the people some of the time. But yes, I'm just getting back with writers after the strike. We are just in the development phase. I'm starting to develop a sequel with the intention of directing it. He goes on to say, the first one was a romantic film and a nostalgic film. I'll be the first person to own up to that without making any apologies for it. I knew it was going to be that from the outset. And now that the characters are established, there's really an opportunity to up the threat levels. Clearly, there'll be a body count, he says, and then laughs. From frame one, it will be unrelenting terror. All those teenage girls who found the movie and mooned over James Marsden or Brandon, well, I'm going to wake them up. Now, you know, the IESB kind of speculates that the unrelenting terror thing is probably a joke. I don't think it's going to be a horror flick. And I'm wondering personally if there's a hint in there when he talks about people mooning over James Marsden or Brandon Routh. James Marsden played Perry White's son. I can't remember his name because he's probably going to die in this next movie anyway. And Brandon Routh, of course, played Superman. But yeah, that's what I'm wondering is if, you know, he's talking about like all these girls loving James Marsden and they're going to be woken up. Woken up by what? Is he going to die? Is he going to die? I can't see if they're looking at a trilogy for this, if they're looking at wrapping this up with Lois and Clark together and having that kind of, you know, nuclear family, nuclear super family, then James Marsden has got to be out of the picture. And I'm thinking for that to realistically happen, for them not to have the baggage of his death, they're going to have to kill him off pretty quickly in this next Superman movie so that by the end of the third one, it will make sense for them to be together, for Lois to have gone through an appropriate period of mourning. Yeah, I kind of wish he would have said all those teenage girls who found the movie and mooned over James Marsden or Brandon and loved that little kid. Well, I'm going to wake them up, because I wouldn't mind that. This is going to sound really, really vicious and mean, but I wouldn't mind if that kid departed the picture somehow. I guess you don't need to kill him, but maybe we just find out like he's actually some part of a fake kid, part of an evil brainiac ploy. I don't know. I'm just not into the Superman's got a kid in the movies thing. I think they should have done that in the comics first. I think when you're making a movie, you don't depart that significantly from the source material, and I think that they made a real mistake in bringing that kid in. Not to say it didn't have some good elements to the plot as a result, but it's a really permanent kind of thing, and now he's got this kid. It's just baggage that the mythos does not need in the movies. Okay, Zach Penn told IESB.net that he is definitely working on The Avengers for Marvel, but he wouldn't get specific. The Avengers is a project in the future, he says. That's the best way to put it until Iron Man and the Hulk come out. I haven't talked to Marvel about it in a while because I think that the best way to do it is to put together a movie that uses all the characters. And so they probably want to see how the movies do and figure that out first. So I'm not sure if that's, you know, if he's suspecting that they'll want to milk the Iron Man and Hulk franchises individually first before doing an Avenger movie, or if the Avengers movie would kind of go right along with those. I did hear from, what's the name of the guy directing Iron Man right now? Dang it, I can't remember his name. But some of you know him. You guys that are geeks like me but are bigger geeks on movies, stuff like this, will know the director's name. But I know he was talking about Marvel wanting to unite their different franchises, superhero franchises, so that they would use like the same actors if they did an Avengers movie. And like I mentioned last time, there's going to be those cameos from Sam Jackson and some other actors between crossing over both back and forth between the Iron Man and Hulk movies this year. So that'll be an interesting, that'll kind of pave the way, I think, to an Avengers type movie. Okay, the Hulk trailer. Now, I tend to not watch trailers. I try to avoid them because I think they give away way too much. But a friend of mine said, you got to check out this Hulk trailer. So I went ahead and checked it out today, and it looks kind of cool. It's definitely with the, they showed Bruce Banner's eyes going green right before turning into the Hulk in one shot, and it was a definite reference to the TV show. I've also heard that they took more inspiration from the TV show this time around. Thankfully, from the clip, it doesn't look like there's going to be a lot of lumbering slow motion stuff. It looks like the Hulk is still going to be moving in real time and being powerful and, you know, rampaging and stuff like that. What I'm not sold on is the CGI stuff. Maybe I'm just getting tired of CGI, but you know, when a movie centers around a character that's like all CGI, it can start to look like Toy Story after a while, you know? And when the Hulk and the Abomination were running around in this trailer, I just thought, oh my gosh, this is the most frightening movie Pixar has made yet, you know? I mean, it's I don't know if it's the textures or it's... I don't think it's the textures. I thought they did it pretty well in the first Hulk movie. I think it's the motion capture. There's something about the physics, the gravity of the way CGI characters move that does not feel real. It's what gave away the CGI in Matrix Reloaded, because I thought the textures they did really good in that movie, but it's the... there's something about the way that they do the motion capture. They don't articulate... They don't get the details right, and so there's something that... just kind of looks animated about it in terms of the way things move. I'm not as excited as I was to see this movie. I was never really gung-ho to see the Hulk. I'm definitely going to see it, and definitely in the theater. But I don't know. I thought the trailer was so-so. Writer-director Kurt Wimmer, who wrote and directed Equilibrium, one of my personal favorites, but then he also did Ultraviolet, which, that was not near as good. It was cool the first time around because just lots of eye candy and stuff like that, but it didn't have a lot of substance to it, which is disappointing. But anyway, Wimmer's going to possibly write and direct the Sony Pictures film adaptation of Konami's hit video game series Metal Gear Solid. That report is from Coming Soon. Online. So that would be really cool, you know, if, you know, I've never played a single Metal Gear Solid game, but I know kind of the basic idea, and, you know, any video game movie is going to be a little bit probably more hyper-real than another movie using the same subject matter, you know, so I think it's going to have more explosions and be more action-oriented and stuff. So, you know, I'm up for seeing a good video game adaptation. And I think Kurt Wimmer has some real potential as a director. He certainly showed that in Equilibrium, an excellent film. So hopefully it'll be more that kind of show, movie, whatever, than Ultraviolet. Anyway, that's all I have to say on that. Right now, I'm going to let you know what's on Pater's brain.
Inside Pater's brain.
Okay, well, what's on my brain this week? Well, the internet, I think, makes communication easier than ever before. But is it always productive communication? And I want to spread this out not just to the internet, but also to, you know, mainstream news media and talk shows, radio talk shows, TV talk shows, or whatever, you know. We've got a ton of news programs filling time slots on CNN and Fox News and other kinds of networks like that, but how much is opinion commentary programming and how much is actual cold, hard facts? Political talk shows will bring exciting guests on to discuss hot topic issues, but the time slot is so limited that people are competing to talk over each other, you know? It seems kind of ridiculous that we would think that the issue can be resolved in a 5 to 10 minute time slot, you know, but yet I think many people form their opinions based on these kinds of little bite-size debates, you know. Both hosts and guests on these kinds of shows seem less interested in discussing and learning and more interested in figuring out their next comeback. I see the same thing on MySpace, YouTube, and any given forum on the web. People spitting out assumptive statements and oversimplified answers to issues that deserve lengthy and repeated examination and discussion. I think if we really want to discuss ideas that we differ on, that we should really be willing to spend more than 5 to 10 minute conversation on it. I think we're going to have to go slowly, and we're going to have to talk about these issues in detail and without the kind of time pressures that can bring on, you know, emotional flurries of, you know, whatever, you know. I just think it's counterproductive. So we have to ask ourselves, I think, are we really interested in the truth? Or have the most important issues for conversation in the world become nothing more than opportunities to feel smart? I mean, sometimes on message boards and online and stuff like that, you know, I feel like people are just trying to kind of say these really make these really controversial statements, fire off some facts, you know, to support them, and thinking it's done. I've won and I'm smart and all that kind of stuff, you know. And I can feel that tendency in myself. My desire, you know, I'll watch a video or I'll read a post that flies in the face of everything I believe, and it angers me, and I feel that real desire to want to respond, you know, to want to get into the discussion, to solve it, to fix it. But I've learned through experience that those are rarely the right times and opportunities to have meaningful dialogue. I'm not saying we can't have meaningful dialogue through those kinds of mediums, but I think that if we, you know, if we go into it believing that the issue is going to be resolved and a victor will be declared, you know, in a 10, 15, or even 60 minute, you know, conversation, we're fooling ourselves, because there are smarter people on both sides of the issue than both you and me that have been arguing these controversial issues, whatever they may be that day, for years. And for us to think that we can just kind of oversimplify it and just solve the issue, you know, in a 10-minute conversation is ridiculous, you know. It's much harder to discuss controversial issues one-on-one in person with someone you know and someone you care about. But I can't think of any better way for us to learn from each other, to really be willing to invest that time and to say, you know, I don't know the answer to that question. Let me look into that and let's come back to this. You know, can we talk about this again? You know, and just have that ongoing open dialogue about whatever it is we're talking about. I think that's how we're going to discover truth. I think that's how we can really value truth, is by being willing to commit to those long-term kind of dialogues back and forth. And I think that's how we're going to move forward as a society. I think as Christians, that's how we're going to move forward in our ability to understand and defend the truth. And so that's something that I really struggle to hold myself to, because I, maybe like you, really like to, you know, fight back, you know, when I feel like something I believe in strongly has been attacked. But this is the challenge I set for myself, and something maybe for you to think about as well. But in either case, for good or ill, that's what's on my brain today.
Every word of God proves true.
Doctrine will set you free.
The grass withers and the flowers fade, but the word of our God stands forever.
Doctrine will set you free.
Okay, today we're searching for truth in the book of Acts chapter 13. Now we're looking at verses 26 through 52. So we're going to finish off this chapter this week. As always, I hope you're reading along with us, because otherwise you're just listening to some dude on a podcast and missing out on the actual words of God to humanity. So please be following along. Let's see here. So Paul knew that he'd be presenting some out-of-the-box ideas to these traditional Jewish people that were his audience. So he very wisely paved the way with lots of references to Hebrew scripture. By quoting Psalm 2, he reminded his listeners that the Messiah would come from David's uniquely blessed bloodline. And the uniquely blessed idea is emphasized in Psalm 2 when the writer is referred to as, when David is referred to as the Son of God. It was nearly unheard of in the Old Testament for someone to be called a son of God. You know, we think of that as a very common thing, or we're all children of God. Well, first of all, as I might have mentioned before, I think when we were going through the Gospel of John, not everyone in the world is a child of God, but still, it's still a very common phrase, and especially in Christianity, we are God's children. We are part of his family. But that was unheard of virtually in the Old Testament, to be called a child of God, a son of God. As Paul made clear, Jesus, descended from the Davidic bloodline, was eligible to fulfill the role of Messiah. Now, Paul's audience understood that some of the promises given to David would be fully realized in David's descendants. And Paul reminds them of this by quoting Isaiah 55:3. You can check that out. And then he zeroes in on a specific promise to David's messianic descendant, that he would not see decay. I want to pause here for a second. This is another reason I think that belief in Christ's resurrection is vital to our forgiveness and salvation. I've met people before that they're willing to believe that Jesus died for their sins, but when it really comes down to it, when it comes to the resurrection, they're like, I'm not sure that he rose from the dead. But then we kind of have to ask the question, well, then why do you think he would have the ability to forgive your sins if he didn't have the ability to raise himself from the dead? How would he have the ability to give you eternal life if he couldn't even conquer death himself? If Jesus didn't really rise from death, then he's not the Messiah. And he can't do anything to restore our relationship with God. I mean, it makes sense both logically in terms of his own power to save us from death. If he can't save himself, he can't save us. And then also just logically with the prophecies, the messianic descendant of David would not see decay. So if Jesus died and his body rotted and deteriorated, then obviously he's not the Messiah. He can't do anything to restore our relationship with God. Additionally, like I said, if Jesus can't save himself from death, why in the world do we think he can give us any kind of real eternal life? Now, Paul finishes by emphasizing the one thing that easily separates Christianity from every other major religion. Can you guess what that is? It seems like I read a story a while back. I don't know if it's actually true or not. Just kind of an interesting little anecdote, though, that some people... I don't know if it was the... I'm not going to remember the name of the group now. Inklings, yes. I don't know if it was J.R.R. Tolkien and C.S. Lewis's discussion group, because they knew each other at university, and they had a discussion group, a writing group that would talk philosophy and writing and stuff like that. So I don't remember if this was something that came up in that discussion or if it was another discussion that C.S. Lewis apparently overheard, but as the story goes, some people were talking about what makes Christianity different from all the other religions, and the group was puzzling over this, and C.S. Lewis said, well, that's simple. Grace. Grace is what makes Christianity different from every other religion. The idea that that the gift of salvation is just given to us. That forgiveness and a right relationship with God is not something earned by us in any way. As much as we should want to honor and please God with the way we live our lives, rescue from eternal death and access to heaven comes only through our trust in Jesus, our trust that he is who he says he is and can do what he says he can do. Like the Jews of Paul's time, I think so many today, including those who might call themselves Christians, believe that if they are a good person, that should be good enough. But compared to Jesus, no one is good, and he's the standard. We can't just, when it comes to these eternal kinds of issues, we have to compare ourselves to the best in the universe. And the best man that ever lived did it perfectly, and that was Jesus. And compared to him, no one is good. Jesus is the only one who can earn a way to heaven. Someone said, I think I read this in a book once, that that our salvation is based on works. It is based on goodness and good deeds, just not ours. It's based on Jesus' good works on our behalf. So that's what he did for everyone. He earned a way for heaven for everyone that chooses to trust in him, to trust that he did that for them. Our role is simply to acknowledge who he is and trust that his work effectively pays the fine for our criminal record, as well as, above and beyond that, earns us good standing and in God's sight. Some of Paul's listeners were convinced about this, others were not. This kind of spiritual transaction, I think it goes against our nature. We want to trust and believe in ourselves. We don't want any kind of crutches, you know. The Jews who rejected Paul's teaching may have felt something similar, but the invitation to have a fixed relationship with God was opened to Gentiles, non-Jews, as well, causing the truth about Jesus to spread even further and change even more lives. Let's see, is there something I wanted to say about that? Crutches. I don't know if I really formulated this thought completely, so it might come out as useless information. But I think that, you know, when you think about Christianity and when you think about how easy it is to find salvation just by believing, by trusting. And I think trusting in our day and age is a better word, because sometimes words like belief and faith and stuff like that, they sound unintelligent. And when you put your trust in something, that trust is based on a history of, hopefully, and, you know, unless you trust something, foolishly, trust is based on you earn trust, you know. So I think trust is a great word to describe what we need to do. And beyond that, there's nothing else to do, you know. And so in one sense, I think Christianity, finding salvation, eternal salvation, is the easiest thing, but it's also the hardest thing. Because I think wired into us is this desire to trust in ourselves and to make our own way and to, you know, pull ourselves up by our own bootstraps, you know, and just kind of feel this sense of accomplishment and significance. I know that I feel that all the time. I want to be significant. I want to accomplish, you know. So I think that's kind of wired into us, and that can be a really good thing. But when it comes to this issue of eternal salvation, we can't depend on ourselves. Humanity has shown consistently that we fail the standard of perfection every time. So let's see here. Jews of high social standing who rejected what Paul was teaching eventually said, you know, enough is enough, and they kicked Paul and Barnabas out of the city. But the two kind of missionaries, we'll call them, just picked themselves up and went on to Iconium. So that's it for Acts chapter 13 this week. Next week, we're going to depart just briefly again from the book of Acts before we finish up with chapter 14 and then move on to Galatians after that. But next week, we're going to take a look, or a listen, I should say, to S.M. Lockridge's famous sermon. It's about, I think, six minutes long or something like that. That's My King is what it is entitled, and I think you guys will find that really interesting and hopefully inspiring and exciting, and it'll just get you revved up and just remind you of what an awesome God that we really do serve. So be sure and join us next week, next Easter weekend for that. We'll see you then. Okay, that about wraps it up this week. I did forget to mention the coffeehouse question. What images or words or thoughts come to mind when you think of the phrase Easter? I'd like to hear from you on that. I've already heard from one person, Jennifer, because I left this, as always, I put the coffeehouse question on Monday with the post for the In Search of Truth, so you can always get an early look at the coffeehouse question for the week that way. And Jennifer writes, I think of Jesus on the cross and Good Friday with Jesus in the garden with the soldiers coming to arrest him. It just sticks there all the time. So anybody else, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what comes to mind, and it could be something of the Bible, it could be something of family or culture or whatever. There's no right or wrong answer to this. What comes to mind when you think of Easter? Jennifer also wrote in response to the What Was On My Brain this week, which I also posted midweek on the Spirit Blade Underground weblog. So she says, I agree with you. The easier technology has made so-called communication easier, it's only gotten harder. No one really understands anyone or even takes any real quality time out to talk about the important stuff. It's just, quote, LOL, I feel that way too, in your inbox or cell phone text messaging. And as for TV, it's all for show, all for money. No one really cares on those talk shows what's said, just as long as they look good on camera. Yes, it's hard to talk to those close to you about big issues, but mostly it just takes time and guts if it's about something really hot. I mean, like politics can, and especially religion, Christianity being the most heated topic in my family, create such opposing points of view that everyone just ends up mad at one another or the issue's dropped without further examination. Okay, I can go on all night about this, but I'm not. That's what I think. I feel we all need to slow down our lives and actually schedule to meet with friends to really talk. And that goes with family, too. After all, aren't they the most important in the end when it all comes shaking down, when tragedy hits? Thank you, Jennifer, for those thoughts. I very much agree and appreciate you leaving those for me to share with everybody. Okay, so as always, I want to hear from you. Just like Jennifer did, you can comment on the Spirit Blade Underground weblog or the Spirit Blade Underground podcast site, or you can record me a message if you've got a microphone on your computer. Go to pater.libsyn.com or patersbrain.blogspot.com, and if you've got a mic on your computer, just click record. There's a one button, basically hit record and just leave your message, and I will play your voice and your comments on the air. So I'd love to hear from you. That's it. Tomorrow morning I'm leaving with my wife and my son, and we're going out to Las Vegas because my parents have a timeshare there, and so we're all going to be, my siblings and their kids and stuff like that are all going to be crammed into this suite at some hotel or something like that. It's big, so it'll be, you know, it sleeps like eight or something like that, but there's going to be just about that many of us in there, so it'll be an interesting week. But anyway, I think I'm going to check out Star Trek The Experience. I wish there was Farscape or Battlestar Galactica The Experience. I think Star Trek's pretty much a dead franchise unless it gets revived by next summer's movie. We'll hope. Maybe they'll put some life and some real human drama in there instead of keeping everything pristine and clean and fixed by the end of every freaking episode. Okay, sorry, that's my little rant. Maybe that'll be a Pater's Brain sometime. Anyway, I'm not sure when the podcast is going to be next week. It'll either come late on Saturday or sometime on Easter Sunday. So just bear that in mind as you are waiting to get the podcast next week. But I definitely plan to be posting as usual next week. We'll have some neat stuff. We're going to hear from S.M. Lockridge, as I mentioned earlier. And then also, we're going to take a look at the Matrix trilogy in a way that maybe you never have before. I think a while back on the Pater's Brain weblog, I posted kind of my theological observations regarding the Matrix trilogy, but I will be sharing those with you next week. Hopefully you'll find them interesting. Lots of cool stuff about, obviously, some Christ references, and the Wachowskis obviously included lots of references to other faiths and religious systems and stuff like that. I obviously won't be giving commentary on those, but I'm going to talk about all the Christian references that I could pull out of there, and some great stuff, you know, about predestination theology, just some wild, really cool stuff that Christians shouldn't miss. And it's been long enough. Maybe it's time to revisit that trilogy and check some of these things out. I hope that you will that you'll enjoy that. So be sure and join us next week. And until then, I hope in all things you're seeking the truth.
Visit www.spiritblade.net. Green Lantern is awesome. Spider is a crazy freak.